What makes a movie good or bad? Well, that's a pretty individual question because we each have things we like and don't like. But there's a lot of common elements in movies that are considered good, and the same can be said for those that fail. The Godfather is regarded as one of the best movies of all time, but can you explain why? Our guest says the opening wedding reception has a lot to do with it. What do you think makes a great movie? Do you have some examples of what makes it great? Join us at 800-642-1234 with your comments and questions. What I want to know is, where's my popcorn? My guest this hour is Anne Hornaday, chief film critic for The Washington Post and the author of Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. Anne Hornaday, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, John.
So, I'll ask the most obvious question first, because, well, that's how I roll. Why do we need a book to tell us how to watch movies?
You know, in one way, we don't. It's kind of, the title is presumptuous, and it's sort of meant to be self-consciously presumptuous, because, of course, we all know how to watch movies. You know, it's the easiest thing in the world. You sit down, and the lights go down, and you let it wash over you, and then you either like it or you don't. But we live in an era, number one, where we're surrounded by movies now. It's not just in the theaters. We can see them on our phones and on our home television sets. And, YouTube is bursting with short films, and we're living in a truly visual age. And we're also living in an age when we can make our opinions known to the world through, you know, social media and commenting on websites, and I just thought that it might, there for some people, you know, for some viewers who are otherwise casual moviegoers, it might be interesting for them to learn a little bit about how a professional critic watches films, just in case they might want to apply some of those ideas to kind of bringing a slightly more analytical or critical eye to just watching movies that they've done for fun so far.
So we're surrounded by movies. They're all around us, and it seems like we care more than ever about what we're seeing. Mm-hmm. You point that out in your book. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I do think during that DVD, you know, that long ago and that long forgotten age of the DVD, you know, which is now an artifact of a of
boy,
a
do I feel old when you say
right?
Long forgotten age of the DVD, because I think I still have some VHS tape in my basement. So,
brother, you know, come over and look at my library sometime, and we'll share. But that introduced the era of the director's commentary, and so people could watch a movie and then go back through it with the director and learn so much about how they were made. And I really do feel like that helped make people so much more media literate and visually literate and cinematically literate. And I've noticed, too, that in recent years, you know, there used to be a big divide between, you know, the critic's opinion and popular opinion. And especially with sort of summer blockbusters, comic book movies, you'd see that, you know, the glib analysis was that, oh, those are made for the viewers and they're not made for critics. Well, viewers are just as critical as critics. I mean, they, you know, it matters to them that it's well written. It matters to them that there's good acting. There, you know, you can't, I don't think studios can just fob off shoddy or half-baked movies just because they're based on a popular source material and expect viewers to come, or at least not come. You know, I think they're leaving money on the table. They've realized they leave money on the table when they don't pay attention to quality and execution. And I think that's because the audience has gotten more sophisticated.
Mm. Well, we certainly have a lot more access to information about how movies are made. Let's talk about the pieces that go into making a typical Hollywood motion picture, if we can say that there is such a thing as a typical Hollywood motion picture, assuming it exists.
Mm-hmm.
What's it? What goes into making it?
Well, you know, for the book, I based the book on some articles I had done for the Post a few years ago, where I approached it a little bit differently. I approached it by craft area, because I think a lot of times you walk out of a film and you might say, gee, that was really well written. And I think most people, when they think of well written, they think the dialogue was good, was funny, or point, you know, really smart or sophisticated or clever, or maybe it had a twist ending you didn't see coming, or a twist. And I think good writing actually is a lot more subtle than that. There's a lot more that screenplays do, a good screenplay does for a movie. So I wanted to kind of approach it from that point of view, which is how do you know as a viewer when something's been well written? How can you tell when something's been well shot and well edited? And so I literally interviewed filmmakers and artists and craftspeople in those areas and asked them, what do you look for? And I didn't want to go at it as, like, how do you do your job? It's more, what do you want people to appreciate about you, what you're doing? Or maybe what are you doing that's invisible, you know, that when we think about it, we might appreciate a little bit more. So I've broken the book down into these craft categories, and I do start with the screenplay because the screenplay really is the foundational document of a movie. It does, you know, obviously, I mean, some you do hear of some movies made without a quote-unquote screenplay. They might come from an outline or some notes that the director jotted down, but generally, most movies begin with a screenplay. And so, of course, that's the story. That's what happens. It's where the writer lays out the arc of the plot and the story, gets into the hearts and minds of these characters that someone is going to be bringing to life on screen. But the more specific, carefully structured, brilliantly thought out and conceived a screenplay is, the better chances it has of being a really good movie when it's finally up on the screen. And it's especially important for actors because if they don't, you know, if they have a really good, detailed, very well-motivated character to play, then they can do their best work.
Hmm. I read, and this is many, many years ago, I was doing some research on radio drama. In fact, it goes back to when I was in graduate school, and we used to take our styli and our wax tablets to class. I'm trying to remember whether this was Norman Corman or Arch Obler. One of the two said that the director is the first and most important, or the writer is the first and most important director of their work. Is that true for screenwriters as well?
That's a really interesting way to put it. I mean, it's generally been thought that the writer is the director on television, you know, because television is such a constricted medium visually that it was really the writer's medium, you know, like it generally devolved into pictures of people talking, what they said, you know, what the words the writer put in their mouths is really the art. But I do think that those lines have really blurred recently. I mean, TV has gotten much more cinematic, you know, and we see much more cross-pollination with people working in both mediums. And unfortunately, I think, because so many movies, you know, because the end point for so many movies is the phone, you know, and the television screen, the most uninspired films that we see are just pictures of people talking, you know, because where they think, well, we're not going to spend a lot of money on a bunch of production value that is just going to, that's never going to be seen anyway. So let's just slap up a couple of people in a cafe and just go from medium shot to close up and we'll call it done. And maybe a few little establishing shots. And so in a way, like some movies have become more like TV while TV's become more like movies. But I still do think, even though I think in the course of writing the book, I renewed and kind of reinforced my pre-existing respect for screenwriters and the importance of the script, it is really the director's job. I still think it's the director's medium because it is the director's job to execute that vision. You know, even the most brilliant script, I think, can be ruined by poor direction, by somebody just making a series of clumsy or distasteful or expedient but not very creative decisions, and then suddenly you got kind of a bad movie that could have been so much better. So I do think that the power rests with the director ultimately.
Can you give some examples of movies that were particularly well written?
Yeah, one of the best writers that we have today is this guy named Kenneth Lonergan, who just won the Oscar for Manchester by the Sea. And he came from the stage, so, you know, he really had his chops very well honed by the time he made his first movie, which was a wonderful, tender drama called You Can Count on Me, starring Mark Ruffalo and Laura Linney. And that was the first time I had ever heard of Kenneth Lonergan or seen his work, and he directed that movie. I mean, he had written, he had worked on screenplays before. He had worked with Martin Scorsese, he worked on Gangs of New York, but You Can Count on Me is his directing debut. And it's very, it's a modest movie in terms of gestures and camera work. It's really about two people, a brother and sister, kind of reuniting and getting to know one another and kind of growing through a very specific experience in their lives. So, you know, you don't have a lot of fancy crane shots or tracking shots or anything like that. But the writing really does shine, and it really is just about the relationship between these two people. But with Manchester, you saw him, I think, really, that was his third movie. He did one in the middle called Margaret. But he's really become more, I think, a little bit more confident with the filmmaking piece. And he's being a little bit more ambitious with the editing and the camera work. But it's still just the writing, the way that he writes characters, his dialogue is all about subtext. Nothing is on the nose. He really leaves it to the viewer to figure out what's going on between people while they're talking about defrosting a freezer or finding the keys to the car. It's just simmering with so much drama and unresolved issues, and I just think it's a brilliant example of why the best writing is really about subtext rather than explicit kind of here is what is going on.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about how to watch movies with Anne Hornaday, chief film critic for The Washington Post and author of the book Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. Wondering what you think. What do you think makes a good movie? Have you noticed good writing in a movie? Do you notice if you think the writing is good, the dialogue that the actors and actresses are uttering? Do you notice when that is particularly snappy, or is that something you really don't pay much attention to? Are you looking for explosions and lots of special effects? What do you think makes a good movie and why? Give us some examples. 800-642-1234. We're going to continue our discussion in just a moment with Anne Hornaday. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back. John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking movies in this portion of the Joy Cardine Show this morning. John Munson in for Joy today. Joy is off watching The Eclipse. My guest is Anne Hornaday, chief film critic for The Washington Post and author of Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. Anne Hornaday, we could talk about scripts and things all day long. You wrote that you hate plots but love stories. What's the difference?
I use that as sort of a way into the sense I think that I have, and I'm sure a lot of viewers have, when you know that something has been cobbled together simply to get the characters to their pre-anointed beats. You know, it's a movie that feels more machined than imagined. It's when things feel mechanical and schematic, and oh, they need to have a conflict here, so boom, you know, I'll just bring in some kind of, you know, plot device that either splits the couple up if it's a romance, or, you know, makes the two cops fight if it's a buddy comedy, you know, a cop comedy. You know, it feels kind of cobbled together from preordained, you know, things that the writer might have read in a how-to screenplay book or something. And a story is really about people. You know, a story is emotional. I would look back to the Kenneth Lonergan example. I mean, he doesn't write in order. As a matter of fact, it's funny, I interviewed him about Manchester by the Sea, and I said, God, it's such an interesting structure that you use to kind of dole out the information about what happened to this protagonist played by Casey Affleck, who's this haunted guy, but you don't know what happened to make him so haunted. And then very gradually throughout the film, you learn, and then in one shocking scene, you really learn exactly what happened to him. And he said, I didn't approach it structurally at all. It was really about the character. It was what was happening with the character at the moment, and that made sense. So it was very organic. It was coming from it was utterly grounded and motivated with whatever was happening with the character rather than what should happen on page, you know, at minute number 25. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the story versus plot is kind of my way of expressing all of that.
Or how do we get to the next explosion or CGI effect?
Exactly, exactly. You know, and it's something like, you know, why maybe like a Wonder Woman, which I thought was wonderful. I thought Wonder Woman was very well written with all of these things in mind. I mean, the character was really, she she was very grounded. You understood exactly where she was coming from and why she was doing what she was doing, and so well acted by Gal Gadot, and such great supporting performances, until that last half hour where it almost felt like, okay, now we got to get the CGI in, and it just turned into a generic, you know, fill-in-the-blank, kind of check-all-the-boxes action scene that could have been seen in any movie, you know, any Transformers or comic book movie, and it felt so, it's like such a come-down after such a specific, clearly well-thought-out, you know, story and characterization on the part of the filmmakers.
Okay. Let's talk about acting. You say that acting might be the most deceptively difficult aspect of filmmaking. Why is that?
Well, A, it's because it's so very important. I mean, I think really, in addition to reinforcing my belief that screenplays are important, I really do have a new appreciation for just how much of an actor's medium film is. I mean, because as a critic, I'm always trying to pay attention to sound design and cinematography and editing, and so sometimes I think I give short shrift to acting. And having kind of, you know, talked to people and gone over my old interviews and really watched movies with a lens, you know, toward writing the book, I think I just have a deeper appreciation for really at the end of the day, it's the actors who matter the most, because it's the actors that, frankly, if you tell a friend, I just saw Blankety Blank, and the first question is, who's in it? And then the next question is, how are they? You know, I mean, it's like, that's what we go to see. We go to see acting. We go to see these faces. And it is deceptively difficult, because I think that, you know, to be a great screen actor, it's different than being a stage actor, because you're not, you know, it doesn't rely so much on projection.
Well, there's no flow either. I mean, if you're on the stage, you're in the story, and the story is happening in real time.
Correct.
And when if you're acting in a movie, you know, you're all over the place in the script, and you have to maintain character. I looked at that and I said, God, I don't understand how these people can do it.
I totally agree with you. And then they're also, to your point, they're at the mercy of the editor and director, who's going to cobble, you know, they're going to be taking different takes, choosing different versions of different takes. I mean, it's a very strange process. And it does rely on this weird alchemy between the performer and the camera. I mean, there's this wonderful quote from Mike Nichols about when he cast Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate, which was, of course, the most counterintuitive choice for that role. And he really took a risk, casting Hoffman. And even on the day when they would be filming, he'd think, oh, this isn't going well. Like, this, he doesn't have it. And then, as he put it, he got better overnight, and meaning, like, he would see the dailies, and it was great. And there's just a certain relationship some actors have with the camera that is magic, and you can't quantify it, and you can't account for it. But it has something to do with, you know, the words that keep coming up when I ask people about it was transparency. You know, it has something to do with withholding enough, you know, being expressive enough that the audience can kind of read you, but then withholding enough that we want to know more. And so I think of people like Robert De Niro, you know, who is so galvanizing and can be so electrifying on screen, but he always holds a little thing back. And there's that mystery that kind of keeps the audience wanting more and wanting to know more about whoever it is he's playing.
Well, you mentioned De Niro, and we do have a clip of this as an example of what a great actor does. Let's go to the De Niro clip here.
You talking to me? You talking to me? You talking to me? Then who the hell else are you talking to? Talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here.
Robert De Niro as Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver, and that's an iconic clip. I mean, everybody knows that bit. What made that such an extraordinary performance?
Well, you know, now you've caught me. I feel I might be wrong. Maybe one of our callers will know. I'm pretty sure that was something that he was just totally improvised. And that might have even been a rehearsal that they were filming, and they ended up using it. I feel like I should probably know this by heart. It's probably in the book, and I've forgotten it. But it's just being alive in the moment. You know, it's knowing exactly what that character would do at that particular time. And just going there. And, you know, something that Dustin, I actually got a chance to interview Dustin Hoffman. I interviewed De Niro, too, but he hates to talk about this stuff. I mean, he's a wonderful man, and he'll talk for, you know, he doesn't clam up or anything like that. But I just feel like when it comes to kind of how he does his job, he really doesn't like to talk about it. But Hoffman did say that no matter what character you're playing, you're not playing a character. You're finding that person within you somewhere, and that's who you're tapping into. And he said if the audience senses that there's any distance between you and a character, and you're kind of saying, that's not me, that's just who I'm playing, they will sense it and they will check out. So I think that what we heard there with Taxi Driver is that kind of person that lived within De Niro somewhere, that he was bringing out rather than putting on as a suit of clothes.
We have some callers who'd like to join the discussion. Let's take a call from Tom in Burlington next.
I wrote a musical with Warren P. Casey, the co-author of Grease. And one of the things about Grease is it has loads and loads of meter changes, and I have loads and loads of meter changes in my music. And from that, my niece is an actress, Lara Flynn Boyle. She was in The Practice, and she was in Men in Black 2. And one of the things that Warren said, I'll just say two things. When we do musicals, you have lots of workshop readings and stage readings. You put the show up, and they criticize it, and then you go back and rewrite it and go back and do things. And so when we did our stage readings, the exact same people that criticized Grease when it first started, her name was Nikki Robbins. She was the first Sandy in Grease. She was the first lead in our show. It's called Ariel Fantastica. But the thing is, Warren said, all directors want to be writers, and you can't let them do that. And it's a very important thing. You were talking about this show that you liked.
Okay. Tom, we have to let you go, but all directors want to be writers. Anne Hornaday?
And, of course, all the writers ultimately want, and all the actors want to direct.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess it is a collaborative medium, though. I mean, I think at its best, you know, a movie's always being rewritten. I mean, they always say it's written three times. It's written with the first screenplay, then it's written in production, and then it's rewritten in editing. And that's probably true. I mean, actors, they write when they perform. You know, I keep going back to Lonergan, but when I interviewed Casey Affleck and Michelle Williams about Manchester by the Sea, they said he writes out every single and ah. Like, you do want to stick to that text because there's kind of liberation in that control. But generally, they said you'd be shocked how much actors mess around with the script and they kind of do their own thing and get away with it. So everybody's putting their two cents in. And so then again, that's why it is so important for that director to have a controlling vision so that ultimately everybody is on the same page, even if they're kind of doing their own thing and putting their own interpretation on the piece. They are at least serving a unified vision, and that vision does have to be the director's.
Tom, thanks for that call. Let's take another one. This time we'll go to Artis in Delafield. Artis, good morning. Thanks for joining us on the Joy Cardine Show today.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. One of the things that makes a movie more enjoyable for me is really, really well-developed characters, even when they have a backstory that maybe you, the audience, can't always see. You know, the act, obviously, it's in the actor, the information, and it just, you know, comes out just so much better and more interesting.
So true. That's very well said. And I think a lot of times you see that's part of the technical work that the actor does. And again, it's invisible. We're seeing the tip of an iceberg that they've been working on, and they do that in various different ways. They might, you know, maybe the writer gave them that backstory, or maybe they went in and did it themselves. Maybe they've done some technical work if their method, you know, they're going into their own sense memories. I mean, everybody has a different way in. But ultimately, that's what we should be seeing. I mean, I opened the chapter on acting with a moment from a wonderful movie called The Visitor by Tom McCarthy that starred the great Richard Jenkins, who's just one of those actors who can stand there and look. I mean, you literally, the first shot of the movie is him looking out a window, not doing anything. But you're almost immediately hooked into this guy because he's just, he's, like you said, like artists said, there's this backstory there that you sense and you don't know it. And then, of course, you know, you get some clues about what's going on with this person. But he is just projecting so much sorrow and tenderness and vulnerability. And, you know, again, it's like he just manages to convey that instantly and get the emotional buy-in from the audience that will go with him wherever he goes.
Artist, thanks so much for that phone call. We often see the phrase production values. You've alluded to it already this morning. When we read movie reviews, what do you mean when you talk about production values?
Well, generally it means just the look of a movie. It's the richness of the look. It's the degree of detail in the scenery and the environment. It could be something like the, you know, the way interiors are either very lush. They might be very lush and very fancy and opulent, or they might be really dressed down and kind of bare bones. And both can be wonderful depending on, you know, if they're serving the story and if that's the correct. But it's really the environment. I guess it's the best way to put it is sort of the visual environment of a movie and the degree, the care with which it's been curated and assembled. And it's a wonderful, you know, again, that's one of the things that makes a movie because you can have very rich production values in television, and we see it right now. But it's that big screen that lets the production value really come into play. So with something like a Dunkirk, you know, that's what makes Dunkirk so magnificent as a viewing experience is the production value that Nolan gets and is able to kind of capture on screen. And it's part of the pleasure, frankly. You know, when you're thinking of a beautiful movie like a Lawrence of Arabia or Dr. Zhivago or, you know, like Sofia Coppola's films are always, I think, just great kind of deep dives into production value. People like Mike Mills, who came to, you know, he's a designer. I mean, he comes to us at, he started out as a graphic designer and pays very close attention to his production designs, his props, the textiles that are used in his films, the little, you know, the jewelry that the people wear. It's just, you know, it's all about the details and it can really convey a lot of pleasure for the viewer.
So we've got the set, we've got the costumes, we've got the props, other visuals. Those things are all part of that production value. What we see on the screen, the totality of that, the way a room looks when someone walks into it, and all the little details of set dressing and things like that that really add to that we don't notice, and maybe we shouldn't notice them, because if we do notice them, that means somebody probably made a mistake.
That's right.
So, but then you've got to capture those features, which brings us to cinematography. You've got a whole chapter on that. The person who's actually taking the shot, the director says, point the camera there. This is what I want. But the person who's actually running the camera is the one who has to capture those production values and make them come alive for us on the screen. How is that done? How important is that to the success of a film?
I think it's hugely important. And usually, you know, when we do talk about production value, it's the product of a collaboration between the production designer, the cinematographer, and the director. I mean, they're really working in tandem to create what we see. So in some cases, maybe a director is not as fluent with lenses and lens length, focal lengths and things like that, or filters. And so, you know, a cinematographer will help them and say, suggest things. But at least, you know, the director at least has to be able to understand the grammar and say, you know, I want this to be, you know, like if you have a really great production design, then you are going to want to capture it with some kind of deep focus photography. And when I say deep focus, I mean, you know, the great kind of granddaddy is Citizen Kane, you know, where you get those long, deep shots of where the subject might be in the foreground, but you see lots of detail in the background. And another example, which is actually, it's on cable right now, is All the President's Men, where that, you know, they meticulously designed the Washington Post newsroom and recreated it in L.A. I mean, down to, you know, the legend is that they had the reporters save their trash and mail it out to Los Angeles. That was a degree. You know, but, you know, I will say, if you watch that movie, it's so authentic. It is just, it looks exactly the way a newsroom looks. And in those shots where basically it's Robert Redford on a telephone, which, even if it's Robert Redford, isn't the most exciting shot in the whole world. But what makes it come alive is the fact that you can see so much activity and detail in the background, and you hear the phones ringing, and you kind of get a sense of the moment. And then Gordon Willis, the cinematographer, he's taking all of that in and giving you all of that value, but at the same time, he's pushing in ever so slightly on Redford while he's making these phone calls and creating a very subtle, almost imperceptible degree of tension in the viewer. So he's infusing what would otherwise just be a static shot of a guy on a phone, he's infusing it with information, tension, emotion, and propulsion all through just the camera, where it is, where it's pointing, and how it moves. So it's a crucial piece. I mean, it's probably one of the most, and it comes down to the shape of the frame. How big is the screen that we're watching? How big is the image? Is it a small squared off image? We saw a movie this summer called A Ghost Story by David Lowery, where he used, I think it was probably like a 1.33:1 aspect ratio, meaning it was almost a perfect square. So it was kind of an archaic looking frame, and with rounded off corners that made it look like a photo in a photo album. And it kind of gave the whole thing a timeless, like an eerie timelessness. Or then you see a Dunkirk, which is just super IMAX, 70mm, big screen, throwback to those big screen epics of yesteryear that we all loved. So that choice matters. Whether they move the camera or not matters. You know, is the camera steady? Is it just sort of quietly observing, or is it in the action? Is it following the subject closely? All of those things. You know, what's the color scheme? That's another case where the production designer and the cinematographer are working very closely together. Is this, you know, like Steven Soderbergh, for some reason, all of his movies have a yellow cast to them. If you see, you know, he likes having that kind of yellowy glow to his films. So it's just picking up on all those little signals those little choices that just make for an interesting aesthetic experience.
We've got a caller who wants to join us, wants to talk about music. We haven't talked about that yet. Joan is with us in Madison. Joan, go ahead.
Yes. One thing she's forgotten to talk about are the music scores that go with these movies that are so memorable. One particularly that I remember, it's an old movie, but it was Tyrone Power, the Captain from Castile. The music was just beautiful. I remember that more than the movie. And also Place in the Sun, the background music in that is really memorable.
Mm-hmm.
And Gomer Trump, the music was of the era. Those are all things that I think make a movie really special.
Okay. Joan, thanks for the call. What about music? How important is that?
Hugely. I'm so glad Joan brought it up. And it is in the book. Because like her, I love music. It's hugely important. And she really brings up a very interesting sort of philosophical question, which is, should you remember the music more than the movie? I mean, in some, like, if you interview all of these craftspeople, to a person, they will say, my job is to support the story. My job is for my work to disappear. And not, because like you said, John, if you're noticing it, that might mean that someone's made a mistake. Because generally, they're all trying to create a seamless, immersive experience for the viewer where we're just in that world and we're not noticing the little things.
Mm-hmm.
And that really does come to the fore with music. Because if you're noticing it, that could mean that the music is overpowering what's going on screen. It could be that the music, you know, is becoming more of a character than the characters, and that can be distracting and kind of take you out. But like Joan, I just love beautiful music, and so I tend to kind of forgive. If I hear a beautiful theme, I mean, I think she's totally right about, I had not seen the Tyrone Power movie, but The Place in the Sun is gorgeous, but people, composers today like Michael Giacchino, who does most of the Pixar movies, he's really this kind of classical, big orchestrations, lush arrangements, just a real throwback to those great golden age composers. Just absolutely stunning, beautiful music. Carter Burwell, who does all of the Coen Brothers scores and did the beautiful score for Carol a couple of years ago, he's one of my very favorite composers. And often I will find myself just listening, you know, like I will take myself out of the movie just to listen to the music because it's it's often just so beautiful on its own.
After writing this book and talking with us this morning, what do you want people to take away from this idea of being a better movie watcher?
Well, I do think, you know, as we've said, it is a collaborative medium, and a lot of people work really hard to create these things, and very rarely, if ever, do they set out to make a bad one. I mean, they are working very hard to create not just, I think, a visual and aural and sonic experience, and a sensory one, but an emotional one, and they take it really seriously, and they go to great lengths to do it with a lot of scrupulous detail and integrity, and so I do think, you know, at its best, it'll give the book will give people a chance to appreciate that work, and then when it's not working, maybe give them some clues as to maybe what isn't working. You know, is it a case where the script just wasn't really finished? Is it a case of was something being over edited, or edited, you know, to a point where it's incoherent? Or maybe not edited enough so that we're too confused. Was this actor cast correctly, or could someone else, you know, was it a case of an actor being cast just because of their name value or their marquee value? So I think it's hope with luck it'll be a guide for both instances. It'll be a guide for kind of helping you know why something worked and also maybe why something might not be working.
All right. Anne Hornaday, thanks for being with us. We're going to make a little bit of a shift here and switch from talking about movies to talking about the upcoming eclipse later today. But Anne Hornaday, chief film critic for The Washington Post, author of Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. Thanks for joining us on the Joy Cardine Show today.
Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
This is John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.